And welcome to Voices in America. And we are the birthday party, a memorial fundraiser, a birthday party for our hostess, Georgia Liga, and a memorial fundraiser for Stephen King Ainsworth, a man, a human being, who is currently on death row at San Quentin State Prison. Georgia, thank you for inviting us to your home this evening.
Thank you for coming.
Can you let our listeners know why you helped organize this meeting this evening in conjunction with Stephen Ainsworth?
Well, it has to be a little of my bizarre nature, to say the least, to be hosting a birthday party for myself with the idea of raising funds for someone who's most likely going to be executed next year. So that kind of ironic tinge to it seemed like it was a good thing to do. And mostly I've been visiting Stephen since 1990, and it was last year that he was giving the signals that, you know, it looked pretty much like he thought it would be more imminent, probably the first of the year 2000. But at this juncture, his latest appeal, perhaps it'll be the end of next year. So it was that kind of, the hardest thing I do in my life is probably to go visit Stephen, just because of the finality. It's every time you visit him, it's the finality that you just gut with death, you know, right there in the visiting room. So it's something we all need to face, and that's, I think, the folks who are gathered here, my friends, all have a take on what the death penalty means for our society.
Certainly, we're joined by a number of individuals and activists and relatives of Stephen today at this, what is now becoming a conversation, a forum on capital punishment, on the death penalty here in the United States and, of course, conversely around the world. What perhaps we could do is ask all of our friends to introduce themselves briefly before they speak, and certainly, I'm sure we'll have some sort of lively discussion as this period of time goes on. Please, everybody, say their name in a one-sentence description of who you are.
Leon Lefson, a retired government, much maligned bureaucrat.
Steve Bertelbo, lobbyist for the Friends Committee on Legislation.
Shirley Faircloth, a retired nurse who is still extremely active in her youth.
Chris Delaney, affiliated with Los Officials, working with the homeless.
Georgia Liga, I'm volunteer coordinator for the Sacramento Area Coalition Against the Death Penalty Vigil Committee.
Carol Thibodeau, sister of death row inmate Stephen Ainsworth.
Sierra Quintana.
Guinness Whelan, old family friend of Georgia's.
Jerry Baskerville, jail visitation program of Los Officials.
Sally Davis, Quaker activist.
Great. Thank you all. Perhaps we could start with you.
My name is Leon. As I indicated in my previous introduction, for a long time I've been interested not only in social problems per se, but in the causes as to why we have so much poverty, for example, in the richest country in the world. Why a people like the American people, who hold themselves forth to the world as proponents of democracy and freedom and social justice and human rights, fail to practice those very same principles within our own country? What is it that accounts for the fact that although as a people we think of ourselves as pacific, as peaceful, when it comes to solving world problems, we are very violent. We have engaged in war from the first days of the found, repeated wars, from the first days of the founding of our republic. And to this very day, our top statesmen and officials look to war as the primary solution to human problems. And I see the death penalty as just another facet of this overall, what shall we say, sickness in the body politic. I mean, we just lack, it seems to me, on a mass scale, a critical sense that would cause us, most of us, to look in to the causes as well as to the surface appearances of social and other kinds of problems as well.
You know, you raise a really very poignant issue, I think. And it makes me think that perhaps a country such as the United States really has gotten what it deserves in the death penalty. You know, you made the statement that we think of ourselves as sort of these great world peacemakers, but we seem to be the most violent country on the face of the earth, and we school our children in utilizing violence as entertainment from the time they're very, very young. And I'm almost wondering if a society that's structured the way our society is structured could do anything but have a death penalty. I mean, it is sort of the ultimate expression of all of this violence, whereby allegedly an entire society collectively engages in the murder of one individual.
I think you've put your finger on something that is very basic, and that is the ability or the lack of ability to make connections. To make connections between the basic features of our society, particularly the kind of economy that we have. We have an economic system which has produced tremendous, tremendous benefits and prosperity for the American people, but which has left in its lurch 3/4 of the world's population. The people in the third world, the condition of the people in the third world, the conditions are getting worse and worse and worse as presumably the America is embarked on the greatest wave of prosperity in its history. There's a disconnect here of major proportions. And Americans don't make those connections because we have a mass media system, a mass media which is part of the kind of economic system that we have, that does not provide its listeners, the bulk of the American people, with the basic facts to help them reach the kind of judgments we'd like them to reach in connection with the death penalty, in connection with poverty, in connection with the lack of human rights, in connection with racism, which is so pervasive in our country, etc., etc., etc.
And for those of you who think the train is leaving without you, let me assure you that it won't. My name's Mike Thornton, and we're doing a Voices in America program, and we're talking about the death penalty. We're talking about capital punishment, and we have a number of individuals, activists, some involved with various organizations, some working on their own with many organizations, to discuss this topic. Perhaps one of our guests would like to jump in. Please do.
I'd like to pick up a little bit on... I'm Steve Bertelbow, and I'm a lobbyist for the Friends Committee on Legislation. And I spend time in the California legislature working against the death penalty. It's an uphill fight. I think we need to face up to the fact that there is tremendous public interest in the drama that surrounds issues of life and death. And the media tends to find it profitable at various levels to play along with that kind of drama. Whenever a crime is committed, when the death penalty is a possibility, that's sure to show up in the subhead of the story about that crime. And the reporter that gets to cover that crime is likely to be able to get a front page play of the story if he plays up the possibility that it might carry the death penalty. So just at every level of the way things work in society, the media tends to feed into this focus that people have and the drama that surrounds life and death issues. And if it's a life and death issue that happens to be created by the existence of the death penalty, that just provides more possibilities for people to get a little bit more notoriety, a little bit more advancement in their profession.
No, I think you bring up a very, very interesting point in the fact that media people, just like anyone else, I mean, you know, why do people get involved in the type of careers that they get involved in? Well, you know, media people who do news, they get involved because they want to cover news and be in the mix and have their stories published. And as you so stated, I think it's very, very true that unfortunately, sex and death and capital crimes sell newspapers and sell radio programs. And I did, as we were talking about earlier, I did an in-depth interview with Stephen several years ago. Now, that interview was picked up by any number of media outlets all the way to Amsterdam. Would those people and those news organizations have been interested in an interview with a prisoner who was not on death row in California? Probably not.
Well, if he committed some heinous crime of violence, such as rape, perhaps. But if he'd been a shoplifter, unlikely.
Probably not. And certainly I think that the media and the people in the media play their role in helping to perpetuate the drama, I think, as you're so putting it. But let me pose a question to all of you. When I speak to people in the media, especially people who are in executive-type positions, they don't say they're just giving the public what they want. That this is what the public wants, that if they try to do intelligent, in-depth programming, that the public tunes out. I'd be interested to hear what you say.
Well, I think it's very true that fear sells. Violence sells. And because we're the preeminent market society, this is what we get. The question is, do we really like to live in a society that is such a slave to the market?
I feel, and I've always felt for a long time, that this kind of reaction from the media representatives is precisely the kind of reaction you get from a major part of our political system, in the people in our Congress, in the Senate, in the state legislatures. We're only doing what our constituents want, they say. But this is a complete and total abrogation of responsibility, because if they are elected to office, they have a responsibility to educate their constituents as well as to implement their desires. But their desires are often related to their education or their lack of education. And so it's a complete cop-out for a politician to say, oh hell, I'm only following the wishes and desires of my constituents, just as it is on the part of the owners of the mass media, who we know are obligated above all to their advertisers and to those who make them the profitable organizations they are.
Well, I was just going to, my name is Chris, kind of agree with you. I'm not sure that the media started this frenzy. I think it was the politicians that started this frenzy about the death penalty. And I think it keeps going because this is the way they say they have sold the people on the idea that we need the death penalty because crime is so terrible and we need it. And then the media picks it up and then we have all these things feeding into each other. I don't think we can totally blame the media I think politicians keep perpetuating this.
Well, it's a really interesting thing that you bring up, because FBI and national crime statistics show that crime has actually been steadily going down over the last decade or so. And at the same time, in particular, local television coverage of violent crime has gone up and up and up and up. When I went to visit Stephen, I was very, very struck by the ritual that the families who were having to visit people who were in the prison system had to go through. And certainly, once again, if we want to talk just briefly about a focus on the media focuses on the alleged criminal, the media focuses on the victim, the media sometimes focuses on the family of the victim. The media almost never focuses on the family of the alleged criminal. Stephen's sister is with us this evening, and perhaps if you could share with us what your experience of having been in the wake of all of this has been like. He says as he puts her on the spot.
Well, it's been 20 years. When this started, we thought it would be over soon. We didn't realize that it would take 8 years for the state to do the required appeal. It's very hard. I push the whole thing to the back of my mind, because until it happens, I don't want to have to deal with it. I'm that kind of person. He's had two dates set, which were, he got a stay at least 2 weeks before, which he had warned me would happen, that there was no imminent danger of him being put to death. But that is very, very scary. He's become a different person than he was 20 years ago. He's a better person, believe it or not, being in death row in cells right next to all murderers. He has become quite knowledgeable in so many different areas that it just amazes me, that I wish that he would have used his talent years ago to better himself. Visiting my brother is much better now than it was 20 years ago. When I first visited him, it was on a telephone with a glass partition. Then they put us in what they call the fishbowl. The death row inmates and families and different organizations campaigned to have contact visits. What they came up with was a fenced-in area in the main visiting room where they would bring the prisoner down in shackles, ankle chains, and make a big production about getting everyone out of the way so that they could bring them in and lock them in this cage. And they would take visitors, and we'd go in the cage also. If you had to go to the bathroom, the visit was terminated. We have come such a long way, and I'm so thankful for those people that fought for that we now have a separate visiting area where we can visit, have a contact visit, sit side by side, and have a real visit. There have been a lot of changes in the death row that I've seen, but a lot of the things they are now taking back away. They had a wonderful art program for a while, and I don't know what's happened to it now. It's, I think, gone by the wayside. People on the outside think that these people don't need programs like that, that they should be locked up and maybe have a chain gang, I guess. I don't know if they do that anymore. But he was becoming a very good artist and a writer also, and he's done my family's genealogy and a couple of other families, and has met many people across the United States that have helped him with this, donated their time and effort. As far as the legal process of this, it's mind-boggling to me. I do not understand most of it. We've had a turnover 2 years ago when one judge turned the death penalty over, the penalty phase of the trial over, and then just last year it was flopped back the other way. It's kind of a roller coaster. Steve has managed to keep his spirits up, keep my spirits up. Now that I've moved closer, I can visit him once a month, and we're becoming closer all the time, which is going to make this very hard. I don't believe in the death penalty, in the fact that it's not applied fairly. The poor people suffer most from it. They're not giving the kind of type of counsel they should get if they had the money to pay for. I know my brother's first lawyer had never done a murder case even. So there's a lot about his trial that should be really looked at and maybe redone.
One of the things that comes to my mind when you're speaking, and I've watched that visiting process and just, you know, been part of it to some degree, but I remember the first time I went to visit Stephen, and I had never been to visit anyone on death row before. It was a new experience for me. And a woman happened to be visiting her husband at the time, and she could see I wasn't quite sure what I was doing, and she decided she'd take me under her wing and help get me there safely. And I really appreciated that then and do now. I was really struck, though, in her case, some really verbal abuse that she had to take from some of the prison guards. She was a relatively attractive young woman, and some guard made some very, you know, very smart comment to her, and she quipped back, and he said to her, he goes, "Don't worry, we'll take it out on your husband later." And I was just very struck at all of the things that the visitors and the family had to go through in order to just to try and spend some time with their loved one. And it was just a very, very amazing thing. And I've always wondered what it must be like for family members that come in there.
It can be humiliating. I've never had any really serious problems. In fact, lately I've had very good luck getting right through. No one in line even. And even an apology for having to wait for Stephen. But I know of people that have had problems. They seem to treat the family as if they're should be locked up too. That they're criminals also, when certainly in my case that's not true. I understand that they have to worry about things being smuggled in and all that, but I go there thinking they may search me. What would I do? I don't know what I'd do. You cannot refuse it. You have to do it. And I know of people that have been searched, scripture searched. And because they think maybe something's wrong, or there's a reason for it. Myself, I've actually had very good visits, and no problems. But I hear those stories.
We're at a memorial fundraiser for Stephen King Ainsworth. My name is Mike Thornton, and this is Voices in America. Two things come to my mind. One, when you're talking, when I went to do my interview with Stephen and actually was going in to interview him as a media person, I had a relatively mid-sized tape recorder, and at the last minute, the prison staff decided that I couldn't take that in, and I asked them why, and they began to reference an attempted escape that happened in the early 1970s with George Jackson. And I said to Stephen, you know, there's just something very, very ironic and kind of stupid about these people worrying about two kind of middle-aged, kind of pudgy old men fighting their way up Death Row. I mean, I could just see it right now. Here we go, Stephen, me and you, you know, and we're going to fight our way out of Death Row with a 32 pistol. But they seem to take it seriously, and that's their job, I guess. The other thing that I'd like to do, and if we could, because it seems fairly unanimous here that most of us feel the death penalty is inappropriate. What about the victims of these men, and in some cases women? How do we speak to their pain?
You know, Mike, we've been doing, since Robert Alton Harris was executed, a noon-hour vigil at the Capitol to just witness against the death penalty. And we approached it from that vigil for Robert Alton Harris's execution. We just kind of sat down on the concrete there outside the Capitol and said, what do? We wait for the next execution, and then here we are again. And there was consensus that, no, we should do something continually and not wait for someone, you know, to be executed to mobilize a lot of folks who are against the death penalty. So this long, we're now in our eighth year of a monthly noon-hour vigil at the Capitol, and we do it in fits and starts. This month, the Friends Committee on Legislation shared the task of showing up with some of their constituency and are very good about wearing black. And that had been one of our premises, was that the groups who are responsible each month would bring flyers of their persuasion against the death penalty, so that we wouldn't just have one party line, you know, and that it wasn't a political stance, it was a moral stance in almost all instances. So that we would wear black in memory of the victims of violent crime. And that's invariably, during the hour witness, we will have snarls from at least half a dozen people. And what about the victims? Well, you don't care anything about the victims. What? And I always wear black, and I always say, we're wearing black in memory of the victims of violent crime. But they don't even hear that. You know, I think if I wore a sign with it, they wouldn't even see it, and they'd say, I don't care about the victims. You know, it's just a knee-jerk reaction on their part. But we're very conscious of that, and the coalition that has been in place since then also has a fledgling committee starting to try to work with victims' families so that there isn't that, you know, just plaining, you know. But then what's interesting, the Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation across the country, when they've tried to bring in the families of men on death row, oh, all hell breaks loose, you know. Oh, you can't mix them. You know, we got victims' families here. You've got murderers' families there. You know, you're going to alienate them. You're going to alienate. I mean, come on. You know, but it's such a difficult situation. But you've got to work all sides, as far as I'm concerned.
And in fact, there is no problem in them getting together, is there?
Not to my knowledge, no. But only from the outside, from people outside who are not impacted by it. You know, personally, they're the ones who criticize it the most.
The people who have not been affected,
exactly,
have a hard time seeing, yeah, both the family of the murderer and the family of the victim,
exactly,
as being co-victims of the event.
Exactly.
Well, that's an interesting question. Why do you think they do that? Why do you think they fear that or fight against having that happen?
Well, the whole issue of capital punishment is one of vengeance. And it would vitiate everything that stands for if you have reconciliation. I mean, the whole problem with our criminal justice system, there is no restitution, there is no rehabilitation. And to think that Stephen would not for a moment spend the rest of his life lovingly in restitution to the woman who was killed, to her family, being in a worthwhile, productive form of selling his paintings or making restitution for that horrible moment. You know, that's something that most prisoners would welcome, plus the fact that they would be rehabilitated in the process. But that's not criminal justice. That's some goofy idealism.
It's restorative justice.
It seems to me that re-educating the public about the death penalty as being totally inappropriate in a democratic society, in a humanistic society, in a society that prides itself on all the things that I mentioned before, re-educating the public in this area involves re-educating them about the victims as well. If we were to get rid of the death penalty, and let's say the ultimate penalty was life imprisonment without parole, and this were to be part of a whole new national approach to dealing with violent crime, then we would have to have, along with it, re-education of the public about our responsibility as a society to the victims as well. So it's a two-part thing, and it has to be seen as being as important, because otherwise you're going to get the kind of reactions we all get today. What about the victims? That kind of thing.
I would like to say something about the fact that state-sanctioned killing is all right, you know. Look at the number of police who've been killing people in this country recently, perfectly innocent people, and they will not do one day of jail time, let alone get the death penalty. You know, it's such a system of injustice. And Carol said, the poor always pay. You know, I don't know whether any rich man has ever been executed for a heinous crime. I don't know.
One of the things that I learned from my conversations with Stephen, when we were doing our original interview, that happened to be at the time that O.J. Simpson was still fresh in everyone's minds. Unfortunately, it still keeps being dragged up again and again and again. But Stephen said a very interesting thing, is that the way the American justice system is structured today, the county district attorney, in essence, has the final word on who will be even tried with the possibility of receiving the death penalty. And so very often that decision is made in a given county in California by one single person. Mm-hmm. And the decision was made in the case of O.J. Simpson, for example, that as a result of Simpson's money and fame and ability to hire a legal team, that the prosecution decided right then and there that he would not even face the possibility of being executed. And had he not been a rich, famous, former NFL football player, that the chances would have been, as Stephen said to me right then and there, that O.J. would have been in the cell next to him right then and there on the day we were speaking. And that is a real issue. I brought up the issue of the victim because I've had representatives of murder victims' families for reconciliation on the program before, and I have also had members of what best could be referred to as pro-death penalty organizations. And it's certainly, I find myself being amorally opposed to the death penalty. I also find myself in a very, very tough position of listening, for example, to a father who's had a daughter murdered. And, you know, how do I judge his pain? And how do I tell him that, you know, you're wrong? You know, I mean, you're wrong. And it's a really hard place to be. And it's a really hard thing to do, to, you know, because I can't say to him, you know, well, you know, you should somehow or another get past this in some high-minded way. I mean, he's talking about the death of his daughter or his wife or his son or his sister or his mother or whatever. I mean, and I think it's a real issue that we need to address.
But some cultures do. Some cultures, in fact, do tell people that you have to get over grief. You have to go on. Azim Kamisa is the father of a 14-year-old, well, 20-year-old who was killed in San Diego by a 14-year-old. And he very quickly saw that there were victims at both ends of the gun. And in his Muslim culture, he says that at the end of 40 days, the grieving is to go on to a different stage. You begin to rehabilitate yourself. And I think in Catholic theology, the idea that it is your duty to forgive, I mean, God asks you to forgive, is built in, and people find it much easier if they're brought up in that way of thinking to deal with the aftermath of being the family of a murder victim than if they haven't had that kind of preparation.
You wanted to say something, right?
I did. I have a hard time with the death penalty. If I could put myself in, if something happened to Sierra, if someone murdered her, I'm sure my first thought would be that guy needs to die, or that person. But I'm sure I could live with it if he got life without parole. And in my heart, I think I could forgive. I think it's up to God to do the rest. But I couldn't live with all that hate inside. It would just eat you up. You have to forgive. It's very hard to do, but you have to do it.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, and that point is, I think, is that very often there are political forces who play on that hate and that vengeance and tell the victim's family, this will not be complete until this happens. And I think that very much is part of the process. That I know at one point talking with some people with Murder Victims Family for Reconciliation, that they were saying, you know, that was what we were being told. In the moment of our supreme grief at the loss of our loved one, that we had these people in authority telling us, you know, you'll never be able to get past this until this person is executed or whatever.
You know, we were talking a bit ago about knee-jerk reactions, and I think this myth, if I may, about closure, you won't have closure until there's an execution, is a knee-jerk reaction. And I think the concept that we don't care about the victims is a knee-jerk reaction, and that the death penalty prevents crime. These are things that the press keeps in front of us, and the one that bothers me the most, because people don't understand it and it doesn't get explained in the press, people will say it costs so much to keep them in prison, it's cheaper to execute them. And this is absolutely not true. Besides being terribly vengeful, it is absolutely wrong because of the costs of the court processes. But we don't see these figures in our country. And yes.
Well, the danger part with that, I think, is when a person begins to make that argument, I think there are people who would seize on that and would say, well, you know what, you're right. It costs too much to execute them. So what we should do is we should have a quicker way of executing them.
Yeah.
And I think that there are people who are using that argument now. I mean, the so-called Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, I think, was part of that process.
Well, the feds have made a very careful study of the costs. And the costs are largely built into the trials, not to the appeals. The appeal is costly, but it's relatively cheap compared to the cost of trying all these potential death penalty cases, because only about 1 in 10 cases results in a death penalty, even though it may be death eligible. And you put all the money into trying to reach a death result in a particular case, and either the judge breaks it down, or the evidence doesn't come in as strongly as the prosecution thought, and here millions of dollars have been poured down the drain seeking a death penalty, and the case doesn't end up with a death penalty. So you have millions spent on preparing cases that are, quote, death eligible, and that's where the real expense of the death penalty lies, not in the particular appeals that result after somebody does get a death sentence.
we're talking about capital punishment, and we are at a memorial fundraiser for death row inmate Stephen King Ainsworth and birthday party for Georgia Liga. My name is Mike Thornton. This is Voices in America. I guess maybe the question to ask is, where do we go from here? As we move forth into a new millennium in this country, of course, we're talking tonight about capital punishment. We also, I think, heard some things that I think are very, very often indicative of certain organizations. Their inability sometimes to work with each other in an effective manner to actually get things done. I mean, we're all really great at kind of holding up our banners and charging forward. As we begin to work our way towards closure of this evening, where do we go from here? What do people who are committed to end the death penalty, what do they need to do to actually see that become a reality in the United States?
Well, some of us are ready to up the ante. There's a group statewide who have not consistently, but have done some civil disobedience at San Quentin. And they're targeting now to kind of orchestrate it so that whenever there's an execution scheduled, that folks who are interested in doing civil disobedience to protest the death penalty, that it's understood it would be the second Saturday previous to the execution. And folks would come from all up and down the state to San Quentin. And what the scenario is, it's still in the works. There are friends that Sister Helen Prejean had given us talk in the Bay Area a couple months ago, and that's where I first got wind of it. And folks now are at the Unitarian Universalist Conference in July up in Utah, and they'll be talking about it more, so it'll gel probably by the end of summer. So folks should get a hold of different people in the anti-death penalty organizations to see if they're interested in pursuing that as an alternative. I mean, it's part of our Neunauer witness was to establish that Gandhian element so that when there was an execution that we felt merited civil disobedience, that we would have done the thing of being there and witnessing and exhausting all possible conceivable protests to end this, and that we would be justified in doing civil disobedience. Now, we've not done it locally yet, but I, for one, am certainly going to join this effort that will be starting up. And it's something new, you know, that. And it's people of faith and secular human rights people, so it's not anything that's exclusive by any means.
I think the other thing that we need to do is we need to lift up the fact that, in truth, most people, majority of people in the United States, would prefer life without possibility of parole in preference to the death penalty. This has been shown repeatedly when people are surveyed about that. While the general question, do you support the death penalty, generally elicits a yes answer, when people are told, if you had a choice between life without parole and the death penalty, you get a slight majority that prefers life without. So I think we need to sensitize more people in the media and more people in the community at large to the fact that this is, that the preference truly is for lengthy prison terms. Life without parole is one lengthy prison term, rather than execution as a way of handling murder cases.
Following up on what Steve just said, I think we have to recognize that the major decisions that are made in this country over time affecting the welfare of the American people are political decisions.
we don't educate our kids, and we are not educated as grown-ups, to really, really grasp this very fundamental fact. Therefore, I think that what we need is a political vehicle, either one of the third parties in this country already existing or to be organized, with a dynamic leader who has the courage and the knowledge and the fortitude to go before the American people repeatedly and argue this very thing, that in polls you yourself say that you prefer life imprisonment without parole to execution. We just saw the example of almost a miraculous political development in the city of Oakland, where a member of the Green Party was elected against all predictions and won, and is all, right off the bat serving as a kind of, I forget the exact term, but anyway, as a real significant voice in the legislature for policies that neither of the two parties have supported. So I think we have to think politically about this as to how best to begin to change the views of the American people about this problem.
It seems to me one of the great hopes, I think, and maybe an untapped source, people that work with youth can do so much in the way of educating our young people. And I think they're the great hope of the future. And I think they may be the way, one of the ways to turn around our dance with the death penalty. We had at a local high school here, Jesuit High, we had they worked with the students on the issue of the death penalty. They took them, a group of students, to visit
Maddie Babbitt,
and they were so blown away, and they went back and told the other students, and they had a whole complete different attitude towards the death penalty because they met someone who was a human being, and they learned all about the injustices, the inequities in the system, and then other students have written essays why they're against the death penalty. And I think they're the wave of the future, and I think maybe we have too much baggage in our society right now, but if somehow we could reach the youth, I think that's a great hope for us.
Well, I think you bring up a tremendously important point, and I think something that the media is very, very guilty of, and that is buying in and repeating that rhetoric of, you know, animal, non-human, you know, that somehow or another it's okay to do this to these men and women because they're really not people like us. They're something other than.
Well, I think another important thing about, like you were saying, about the people preferring life imprisonment without parole to the death penalty, I think that the percentage of people who prefer that would actually rise if there was some kind of campaign to tell people, when we say it's life in prison without parole, it's really no parole. Because I think in the mind of the public, they hear, oh, you a life sentence. And that means everybody thinks, okay, he's going to be out in 14 years or something like that. But I think if you set it in their mind that really it means they're not going to be out on the street again, really it means that they're not going to die either, but they're not coming out again, then I think if people could actually understand that, they would come out more and more in favor of it. I think that the numbers would actually rise.
You're so right, because people read about Charles Manson, who happened to be convicted during a time when you didn't have the death penalty in California, going back in to have his parole date, and they say, my Lord, what is this?
Yeah, this guy can get out, anybody could possibly get out. Right?
Yeah, so there is a vast gulf there. And it's interesting. People don't trust the bureaucracy to keep a person sentenced to life without parole in prison. But
they're ready to trust the government to administer a death penalty. I mean, that's a very curious juxtaposition.
Well, because not trusting the bureaucracy to do anything right in most cases is usually pretty smart, I think.
We're having a pretty high-level discussion, and we're a pretty educated group. I'm grateful that there are movies coming out that appeal to everybody. When Dead Man Walking came out, and we wondered if it would draw the crowds, and it did. And just the other night, I was amazed. I had checked out 7 years in Tibet, and here, the Dalai Lama, as a growing boy, is being taught by the visiting escapee from Austria about why we don't want the death penalty. And I thought, my goodness, this is wonderful in a popular movie with Brad Pitt.
Oh, gosh, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, recently there have been a lot of cases that have been turned around, too, where they found out that someone was imprisoned for years and years and years unjustly. And if they had been on death row, they would have been long gone.
Right, and in a number of recently publicized cases, people who were on death row, in fact, were found out to be innocent and released after many years awaiting to be executed. In some cases, I believe there was one, I wish I could remember the name, where the man was, I mean, within days of being executed, and a group of journalism students were the ones who investigated the case and found out indeed that the man had been innocent.
I think that was Northwestern in Chicago.
I believe it was, that's correct.
It's hard for us to accept the idea that we have a judicial system that is very capricious. But the lawyers that are closest to this system have been saying now for a couple of years that the system isn't that good and that we really need a moratorium on this thing before we do permanent damage. So I think this is one time when we ought to be listening to the lawyers.
Oh, boy. We just have a few minutes left, and what I'd like to do is to let everyone take an opportunity to make any final statement they would like to make and have our last go at our roundtable forum tonight on capital punishment as we begin to close our evening, our memorial fundraiser for Stephen King Ainsworth. Any final thoughts as we work our way out of this Voices in America segment?
I detect a shift in public sentiment around the death penalty. And I think it's media sentiment much more than public sentiment. I've said already that the public generally would prefer something other than the death penalty. But I think that reporters are beginning to catch on. I heard one of them interviewing somebody a couple weeks ago who said, well, we've tried the death penalty and it hasn't worked. Now, that's an unusual thing for a reporter to be saying, and the guy he was interviewing didn't argue a bit. The Littleton case demonstrated that there are an awful lot of people that do damage, that do violent things in our society, who are, in effect, suicidal. They don't care about their own lives, and for them, the death penalty is not going to be returned. And so some of the things that are most scary to us are not at all helped by having a death penalty. I think as that consciousness begins to spread, that the enthusiasm for the death penalty among people in the media is going to wane.
I certainly, on many levels, I think agree with the statement you just made. I also have to say that I was listening to a radio show this morning in this very town, and I listened to two guys laughing and hooping it up and making fun of the fact that the man was executed in Florida last night. And perhaps these are two competing forces in the media. We certainly hope one will win out. But I don't think that the consciousness has been turned around enough yet, because I was appalled at listening to these two mainstream talk radio hosts laughing and joking about a man being electrocuted last night, and that this was commercial entertainment in America in the morning as people are getting ready to go to work.
Well, somebody ought to fire those guys.
Well, unfortunately, as long as they get ratings, I can assure you no one will.
And it says more about the market than a lot.
I share a July birthday with Jerry, so let us hear from Jerry before we close.
Well, I think in particular the whole system, as someone said earlier, needs to be revamped from day one. We need to educate from the youngest age to the oldest age, and that we can't give up. You know, that wherever we are in our search for justice, that we have to continue to fight for it and not to be silent.
I think in a broader context, we have to, in whatever educational efforts we undertake, draw parallels between what we do as a nation abroad and domestically has a lot to do with our attitude toward crime in this country and in our own country. And that we have to try over the long term, because it can't be done quickly, to change the attitude of the American people from punishment to rehabilitation. Now, there's been a lot of lip service paid to this in the past, but it seems to me that it's the only alternative, and because when you move from punishment, which is a simplistic approach, to rehabilitation, which is a much more complex approach, you are forced to come to grips with the causes of crime as well as the punishment for crime. And when you begin to come to grips with the causes, then a whole new panorama of factors opens before the average citizen.
I think that to change the criminal aspect, or the criminality of our society, that we need to start rehabilitation when the person first hits the prison system, and generally that's when they are teenagers, and today even earlier, that they need to be rehabilitated from the beginning and not put the emphasis on punishment and degrading.
Well, I think what people are finding is that if you're going to have an effective violence prevention program, you really need to start before birth. you need to start by eliminating violence in the home. Because when children are witnesses to domestic violence, they become much more vulnerable to being violent later on. And so that's a whole other effort that needs to be undertaken.
Well, I think that the most marvelous thing about this birthday celebration as a memorial for Stephen's fundraiser is the fact that the complexion of this gathering is so varied, and if there's anything of hope for the future, for the new millennium, that we're atheists, we're Mormons, we're radical Catholics, we're Muslim children, Quakers. It's just a marvelous eclectic group with a common bent to try to do something better in our society. And as sick as it is, it's our society. And if we don't do it, no one will do it. So it's just a marvelous testimony, I think, of the unity that can come when you share a common bond and a common humanity.
And I'd like to thank all of you for sharing this evening with us, a memorial, a fundraising memorial for death row inmate Stephen King Ainsworth, and also a birthday party. My name is Mike Thornton. This has been Voices in America. And before we all go, Georgia Jerry. Happy birthday.